Hello and welcome everyone to Minute 36 of The Great Escape Minute, the daily podcast where we dig into The Great Escape 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob.
I'm Tom.
And joining us today is Jim O'Kane of The Rocketeer Minute and The Apollo 13 Minute. Welcome, Jim.
Hi, guys. Thanks so much for having me on this show. This is one of my favorite. I say this a lot of times, but we seem to be doing a lot of favorite movies, and this is one of my favorite movies. I mean, I go way back with this. I can remember being a kid in the 60s watching this on – it was like – that was a big night when it was shown on CBS. You know, all night was going to be The Great Escape, so you had to sit down and watch it. So this brings a lot of rusty neurons back to life.
So you were happy actually to see it without commercials this time?
Yes, it's so nice without, you know, watching for donut commercials and Chevy ads. It's much shorter too.
Yes, especially when you only watch 5 minutes of it.
Yeah, that's true. It's such a great caper film, and back in an age of caper films, and it's
unique in what it does.
Yeah, it's a beautiful film. It's not that much different from other caper films like Top Cappy or Ocean's 11 or even the Mad. It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. They've just got to get to the end, and everything goes wrong in between. Great. It's a great formula, but they managed to make it seem very original in its presentation.
Well, it's partially because of the fact that it's, you know, based on truth. I mean, based very, very loosely, I use that term. But, I mean, have you read the book that this is based on?
I have not read the book. I have not
read, ooh, read it. Something read that it. I know that Jim doesn't. Wow.
There you go. Right. Yeah. I realize it's based on a real thing. I mean, there really was a Stoglove 3.
Yes.
I've watched the making or the documentary that came with the DVD. But yeah,
you mean the return to the Great Escape?
That may have
the one that has the interviews from 1992. It has the interviews with a lot of the cast members.
Yes,
is that
yes.
The one? Okay. Yeah. Right. You should also check out the Coolest Guy movie. That's also there's a 1 hour documentary that came out about 2 years ago. Both of those are actually written by someone who we're going to have on the show in a few months from now.
Awesome.
Steve J. Rubin. That's who it is.
Oh, yeah. He also wrote the unauthorized James Bond book. Yes. We have mutual friends. He's a great guy. Yes.
Yes. He was very helpful for us. I mean, he was able to get us some context here that we never would have gotten otherwise. But we won't discuss those either.
Okay, yeah.
Those will come up later in the season. Yes. Don't want to give too many spoilers here.
The scene that you've given me here, this first minute, is such a classic. You know, putting the team together as to who does what. They do everything but build a small model of the town and have a DeLorean to drive through it.
So, exactly. All right. So episode 36 starts off with Big X continuing to discuss his plan for the Great Escape, and it goes all the way until Big X says, "I want." And that gets cut off, and we'll talk about what he wants tomorrow when we get to that point. But yes, Jim, you're completely right. I mean, this is a perfect setup to explain to everybody what's going on. I mean, you're right. They could have used a little model of the camp and showing us everything. But I think they do a good enough job giving us a visualization of what all of the various jobs are of each of these characters. I mean, this scene continues from the last week. We discussed a few of the minutes that we're dealing with the beginning of the scene. But this is the one where he specifically gives out all of his different jobs to everyone, which is interesting to actually look at. I mean, the first thing he says in this minute is he gives orders that he wants maps, blankets, rations, compasses for all walkers, including train timetables, which, again, all of these characters just got into this camp today. You know, it's amazing how quickly Big X's mind, you know, is able to form a plan.
Done this 3 times before too, right? Hasn't he?
He's done this more than 3 times. He's done this many times. But again, to do something on such a big scale and to think of this type of plan of okay, we're going to have 3 tunnels. We're going to go one from here, one from there, one from the other place, and this is what we're going to do. You know, he didn't have that much time to plan it all. You know, he had to scout out the camp and see, you know, where everything was going. And he did this apparently all on his own in order to get everyone together in this meeting room. So it really works well the way that this minute starts off. And that's one of the reasons why we wanted you on this week, because this is a great minute that deals with a lot of the exposition of the film. We obviously want to hear your thoughts on it also. Besides what we already know about it.
Oh yeah, I mean it's beautiful. Exposition is always a difficult thing. You can make it fascinating, or you can make it a dull dishwater. I love all caper films that have this particular scene where they're gonna lay out the whole system of who's in charge of what. We're getting the org chart here. We get and it's also it's a semi reintroduction. I mean, we've seen these faces around the camp. We've seen at the beginning of this, we've seen all these different faces, but we don't know who's doing what. So we meet, like, Willie and Danny are going to be the Tunnel Kings, and Sedgwick does manufacturing, and all these different characters. We go, oh, that's who they are. You know, Gordon Jackson is Mac, for example. He's intelligence. He's going to be finding out what's going on outside the camp. He has to coordinate with other people. So these are like the department managers coming up with all their stuff. We meet Henley, the scrounger, who's supposed to get all the merchandise so that all these other guys can do their jobs while they have a tailor building. I keep thinking about tailor making enough civilian outfits for 250 people, and it just, that just kind of flies by your head. You're like, wait a minute, how's he going to do that?
It's not only the tailor, it's everyone. These different characters, all of their jobs are they're dealing with things on a very large scale. I mean, we're not even manufacturer. I mean, he's got to deal with. Obviously, a lot of these things we only find out later during the course of the film what they're actually doing. Here we just hear their titles, which some of the titles sort of make sense. You hear Tunnel Kings, okay, you know what that means. Diversions, you sort of know what that means if you've never seen this before. That's what I'm talking about. Intelligence, you sort of know also. You don't know to the extent of what they're dealing with here.
And things you might never. Even have thought about. It's like, if you're digging a tunnel, how are you going to get rid of the dirt? So you give it to, Eric has the job of disposal. How do you get rid of that much dirt out of a tunnel and hide it somewhere on a camp that you can't leave?
So, right, and the movie doesn't even get anywhere close to the various ideas that are described in the book of what they really did.
Yeah.
I mean, they found, it's unbelievable. I mean, if you read the book, you'll see the places they found to hide dirt are just mind-boggling. There are things that people never would have thought of, and obviously the Germans didn't think of it either, because they were able to get away with hiding so much dirt. I mean, at one point they actually take dirt from one tunnel and fill up the other tunnel that they've already dug, because they said, okay, we're closing that one for now, so what are we gonna do with the dirt? We'll just put it back in there, and we'll worry about it later what we're gonna do when the dirt there is finished. They have something in the movie that's never mentioned is apparently there's like a recreation hut where they can do like theater and stuff like that. And they decide that they're going to, put dirt under the stage. And it's unbelievable how much dirt they're able to get. The book explains the amounts. I mean, I'm not a mathematician, so I can't really, go into the detail of how they figured it out. But they explain that they were able to get so much dirt packed into there. It's just amazing. I mean, this movie is 3 hours long, or almost 3 hours long, and it could have been so much longer if they went into even more detail of things and it would have, in my opinion, it would have stayed it would have stayed interesting even with that.
And who would have thought you'd have been that fascinated about tunneling? Yeah, it just seems like, yeah, okay. But
Well, we can actually all be thankful that this was made in the 60s, because in real life they all stripped down completely in order to do the digging. So at least we were able to only see all of these actors dig with clothes on.
One of the things that I was thinking about while they were discussing the tunneling has been such a part of warfare. I remember going to Petersburg, Virginia, which is it's just outside of Richmond, Virginia. There's a rather famous siege that took place there during the last year of the Civil War, and there was a large battlement built up, this big parapets and impregnable fortress that the the rebels try to figure out how to get the Union troops try to figure out how to get into this Confederate fortress, and they just happen to have with them a contingent of Pennsylvania infantry, all of whom were from like the Scranton area, which, you know, Wilkes-Barre, which
they're coal miners.
And the officer was looking at this place going, how are we ever going to get through those parapets that they built? And one of the NCOs that was there said, well, we could go under it. And sure enough, they dug a hole underneath the parapet and then loaded it all up with gunpowder and blew it up. They blew a hole in the middle of this thing. Unfortunately, one of the things they didn't plan on during this raid on Petersburg was that when you blow something up, you wind up with a large mud-filled crater. So all the Union troops went over the hill into the crater where they were being picked off by the Confederate snipers who had, you know, had the high ground, and just it was a pretty brutal battle that was fought. There was one of the final battles of the Civil War. And going there, when you see that the hole in the ground is still there after 130 years or so. But it's just a 160 years. Sorry, I'm old. 160 years, yeah.
155, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's this massive hole in the ground that remains there to this day. And you see about how big a hole they blew. You realize how deep a hole they had to dig in the first place to get down to set that off. Seeing this mining thing reminded me of that part of warfare.
I mean, it's still being done today.
This is a conceit of the film, and it's okay. They shot it this way because this is how audiences are familiar with. The only problem I have with this particular scene is how well lit everybody is in the film. those Germans really knew how to light a POW barracks, which
library. This is the library. They're in the library.
Okay, yeah, in the library. So
apparently, come on, you need good lighting in the library in order to read all the books. I mean, we figured out that there's a whole bunch of books on the side. There's probably a couple copies of Mein Kampf, and maybe there's copies of How to Break Out of Prison Camps.
Yeah, well, apparently, and there's one on cinematography too, because they've all got key light and fill built all three sides of them. Beautiful image of X there. He just keeps walking in and out of these rim lights that perfectly frame his hair. And it's just funny how they're all, he knows exactly where to walk, so that he gets to the next 3-point lighting setup.
I wonder if that's the Attenborough who aspired to be a director, making sure that he was well lit.
Yeah, no, it's a beautiful thing. But, you know, nowadays this would have been shot with a lot more high contrast. It would have been people have been poking in and out of shadows talking. But gosh, you think about how much light they had to throw on that thing for it was filmed in deluxe color, so that it was a really slow, very rich film, but to light up that back wall where Attenborough and Garner are standing in front of that takes a lot of light to dress up that room. So it must have been pretty, and they're all wearing wool coats, and it couldn't have been cool back. This is pre LED, so have been one hot set.
Yeah, there's no question about that. I found it interesting the way that some of the characters are referred to by their last names, some of them are referred to by nicknames, some of them are referred to by their first names. I mean, throughout the movie you have this, you know, where Henley is rarely called by his first name. You know, he's and you have the same thing with Cavendish. This is one of the few times where he's referred to as Dennis. And then you have Colin. I love the way that they're saying everyone's positions of what they're going to be doing, you know, and then he goes, Colin, you get your usual job. And that obviously is just to set up the next scene. There's nothing, there's no logical reason for him to say that, except for to say, okay, Henley won't know.
Yeah. Well, and Colin is, he's called by his first name because I think everybody there feels sorry for him because he's the – yeah, even though he's part of the military, he's a rank civilian. He was supposed to be. Well, we'll get into that in a future minute. But he's not supposed to be there. And I think everybody kind of feels bad for him because he's the guy they were supposed to be protecting behind the rear echelon lines.
Right. Well, now, did you notice? Did you know? Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Tom.
Well, I was going to kind of go off of the name thing, and even active duty military. I mean, there were people I would call by their first names because you know, were of similar rank, or those are the guys I spend my weekends and stuff with. And then there's the guys, it's, you know, they're either above me in the chain of command, or I just don't spend much time with them, and then they get called by their last name.
And right, okay, but in this scene, we're dealing more with them all, you know, getting an overview of things that are going on. This isn't a conversation. I agree with what you're saying. If it's a conversation, you know, when you speak to someone that you're more friendly with, you're going to speak to them using their first name. But here, they're getting a briefing, basically. In a briefing, you'd think that it would be a little more formal.
Yeah, but when you get, I mean, because I've had to sit in on some officer briefings, and there it's all first names. It's a little weird they don't stay consistent. They, you know, either everyone's going by their last name or everyone's by their first, but officers calling each other by first names definitely is not abnormal. At least yeah, no, in the no, U.S., no. I don't know about Israelis.
Right, no, no, example. No. That's fine. My point was not about, my point was the inconsistency, not the idea of the informality of it all. Did either of you notice that when Blythe shows up late, he has like he gives a special knock on the door?
Yes, the one knock and then the two after.
Exactly. Yep. Exactly. So that they know that he's allowed to come in, you know, and that no one set off the alarm that someone's coming, you know, that shouldn't be there. I also found it funny that he comes in, salutes to Roger, and then apologizes for being late. And, like, no big deal. You can be late. Maybe that's back based on what you were saying before, that, you know, everyone sort of feels bad for him because he's a civilian. And I love his reaction. His reaction to everything is splendid. Everything's splendid. You know, here I am in a POW camp, you know, but everything's splendid. You know, we're going to tunnel. Ooh, splendid.
I think his whole section in here, or his way of dealing with the world is, well, this is my life now. This is the way things are. So,
we'll get that later in the week also. I have a few comments to make about him being okay with this is his life for now.
Yeah. Any idea when we first come in, the first couple of seconds there, as we see Colin approach, I know this is difficult on people that are listening in, but they'll have to go to minute 36 and watch. That's all there is to it. Behind Colin on the wall, what looks like a giant Philly steak sandwich in a poster. I don't know what that is. Around second 13.
Yeah, we've tried to figure out what's on the wall there in the library. I mean, when we were dealing with Von Luger's office, it was a little more easy. It was a little easier to figure it out. I see what you're talking about here.
It just looks like a really melted, cheesy Philly cheesesteak sandwich. I've tried picturing other things, but it's like, it's not a map. It's not a...
Right. Unfortunately, you can't, like, zoom in.
Yeah.
To try to see. I mean, there's what about vase or a pitcher?
That looks really strange. It's that, not anodized, but it's enameled. It's an enameled pitcher. So I'm assuming it contains water or something like that. They don't want it to... usually enameling a pitcher like that prevents it from getting mossy, the water.
I guess the idea is to make it easier to drink when you're in the library.
Yeah. And they've got postcards. Apparently people are sending in, you know, having a wonderful time, wish you were in Capri.
Were in Stalaglyph 2.
Yeah. The ocean breezes from the Baltic really feel good, yeah. They do have an awful lot of books. I'm guessing that the Red Cross dropped them off, or maybe they're all in German, or hard to say what that is.
Yeah, but there is a group of books there that look like maybe encyclopedias, you know, on the bottom shelf, you know.
A very thorough card catalog too, just to make sure that nobody walks out of the camp with the library books.
Which they just got here today. That means the Germans are being efficient, unless they bring the books. No, they couldn't have brought the books with them, because we've seen what little things everyone carries with them.
Yeah. I don't think it's Dewey Decimal, so it must be reference books or something. I'm not sure how they're stacked in. I don't. Well, they need to get. Nobody's been issued a "You're the librarian."
Maybe. Well, it looks like Max the librarian.
Oh, okay.
He is sitting at the desk.
Yeah, that's right. He's in charge of intelligence, so maybe, that's true, you know, how do you get intelligent? By reading a lot of books.
So I did have a couple of questions about this whole setup, and you know, just things that don't really seem to be explained throughout the movie that just strike me as odd in this minute. So Willie is also in charge, or not, Bronson is also in charge of traps. And I'm curious what they're, you know, I don't know if the book says anything, or what do you guys think Roger says when he says trap, means when he says traps?
He's talking about the trapdoors, trying to seal up the entrance to the tunnels.
Yeah, I think
that we see later on when he breaks the concrete, and then they have to put a concrete slab in.
I guess, but yeah,
that's always Danny doing. You know, he's the one with the pickaxe breaking through. So that's what they're referring to. I think that's what they're referring to when they say traps. Now, I also found it interesting that Big X says only to Danny, "We'll discuss these We'll discuss the locations tomorrow." You know, everyone else, he gives them their jobs, and he says, "Okay, we'll talk about everything." You know, while we're all exercising. But specifically to Danny, he says, "We'll discuss specific locations tomorrow," and not to anybody else.
Yeah, they have. I think they're just trying to limit need to know, and also they still haven't. I don't think they've fully scoped out the premises. So he's gonna have to wait for some more intelligence reports from Mac to figure out where, you know, what's the closest to the trees. Where, you know, how far away can they get away with it? And
They can ask Cavendish to do a wrong survey,
yes.
You know, an incorrect survey. That's what he's there for. He's there for incorrect maps and surveys.
Although it is, I will say, in Cavendish's defense, it is entirely possible Danny doesn't know how to measure what he's dug. I am all on board for blaming Cavendish for this entire thing. I feel like at some point I need to throw Danny under the bus for a minute.
No, but they do have the string that they measure on the inside. So it's a question of comparing the string on the inside to the survey on the outside. But yeah, okay. We're going to be discussing this issue for many, many months.
With Danny's constant problems with claustrophobia and being confined, it may be everything feels like a mile to him. You know, I've got to do a mile now. Look how far it is inside the tunnel.
Could be.
And this will be number 17. Is that right? He still So practice makes perfect, I guess. But we'll see.
And he gets out this time.
So yeah, that's
spoiler alert.
So the other question I had is, I can understand where a lot of the things they get come from. Where are the compasses? How do you get 250 compasses in a POW?
The book actually explains it.
Oh,
I think you can make them.
Well, but you
made them. They made them. Basically, they were able to find. I can't remember. So I'm not a chemical person or whatever. So I'm not really a scientist. So I couldn't tell you specifically what they used in order to make the compasses. But the book does describe the fact that they were able to get like mercury or a little bit of aluminum from things, and they were able to create compasses. They're not, you know, standard compasses that everyone's going to be using. They're makeshift compasses, but they're still compasses.
Okay. Because I was looking, I was trying to do some research on homemade compasses, but everything I was finding looks like it lasts for 2 hours, you know, but they're, most of the ones I found were the homemade Boy Scout ones, you know, rub a magnet on a needle for a bunch of times, and then it works for an hour or so before the magnetism kind of dissipates.
Well, yeah. If you have a magnet with a high K level, you can do it for a couple of minutes and it'll last an hour. But if you have somebody in charge of magnets and you have it sitting there with a high K magnet for days, eventually if the metal is narrow enough and it's of a high enough quality, it should hold it for weeks. And then all you just need is like mineral oil and a case. I'm sure these guys figured it
out. I can explain to you from the book. It says so they made the compass castings out of broken gramophone records, heating the bits till they were soft as dough, and then pressing them into a mold. Artists painted the points on the compass accurately on little circles of paper, and they fitted neatly into the base of the casings. He sank a gramophone needle in the center of the base of the needle pivot. For the needle pivot, the direction needle itself was a bit of sewing needle, which he rubbed against a magnet. They were able to magnetize these needles and find a way to have them work.
Yeah, and you can probably get magnets out of one of the trucks that were on, you know, one of the many trucks that were there, part of the starter motors. You still need a stator.
but you won't get 250.
No. You just need one major right, magnet, and that'll magnetize everything else. You just need to do it once. You get one of the starter motors out of a truck, and then just take that apart and grab, take it off the stator. But those boxes in the background, I just keep thinking there's like five. Ark of the Covenant. it looked exactly like the box that was in the Bantu Wind.
I think those boxes all have more copies of Mein Kampf.
Yeah.
in case you run out.
Yeah.
Right. I also love his conversation with Eric when he's the first thing he says to Eric is, have you thought about how you're going to get rid of the dirt? And my first thought was, wait a second, you just told him 30 seconds ago that he has to deal with dirt from three different tunnels, and now you're asking, have you decided what you're doing with them yet? And thankfully he responded appropriately and says, well, I didn't anticipate you'd give me three tunnels, but we'll manage in the usual places, which is an interesting way to basically shut him up. and then the last person who speaks here is when Soren says, who's going to handle security? Which is one of the stupidest things to ask. Because if he's the security guy who's been, you know, he's in the X organization as a security guy, why is he asking that question?
Oh, that's me. That's on me? Oh, yeah.
He's like, oh, crap.
Well, yeah, he's like the guy that raises his hand and tells the teacher that they forgot to give his homework. Are you volunteering? Thank you. Wow.
Well, and I wonder.
Yeah. Well,
I was going to say, I was wondering if he was previously security or was he some other role in a different camp that now that they're together, he gets up, you know, promoted or demoted to security.
Well, that is a valid point, but they mentioned before, last week we discussed it where Roger and Ramsey are speaking together about do they have the whole X organization with them. So he would have said that besides missing the Scrounger, we were also missing someone for security. Probably. I would think. But again, maybe he was number two beforehand, and he's like, well, you know, the guy who was number one isn't here, so who's going to be dealing with it? Who knows? Could be. And I love how this is the scene where Big X actually meets Henley. You know, he's mentioned to him beforehand, and Henley is invited to this meeting, which is also interesting, because here you have a meeting of the X organization, and so, I mean, we discussed this, I think, last week, that how do they know they can trust Henley? So the answer that we came up with, correct me if I'm wrong on what we said last week, Tom, was that basically someone must have vouched for him from another camp or something like that because he's taking over the role of someone else. So he's told, okay, come to this X meeting, and then Big X is talking to everybody. He's saying, you're in charge of this, you're in charge of this, and you're in charge of this. And then he looks at Henley and says to himself, this is the guy I don't know, so this must be Henley. So then he goes, oh, we've never met. And he shakes his hand. And then he goes, you're the Scrounger, right? And he goes, right. So.
Well, he's the only guy with USA written on his sleeve. So he's like, oh, it's either him or 15 other guys in the Hulk.
He must be the American.
Yeah.
No, and we established a few weeks ago that in this camp specifically, obviously not in the real camp, there were 15 Americans who were transferred out a few weeks before the final escape happened. But in this one, they've already Goff already established that basically there's only three Americans in the whole camp.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah. So do either of you have anything else for this minute?
I'm not sure. I think we have James Donnell for one more minute in this, or the beginning of the next minute. So I wanted to say some things about him, but we could save it for tomorrow. Let's save it for tomorrow.
Okay.
All right.
Very good. Tom, you have anything else?
I do not.
Okay. Jim, you want to tell everyone how they can get in contact with you?
You can listen to my shows. We've done the Rocketeer Minute. We've done, Apollo 13 Minute, the Airport Minute. And then all the group movies by minute ones like Into the Night Minute and North by Northwest And currently, as we're recording this, the Best Minutes podcast covering the 1946 William Wyler directed feature, The Best Years of Our Lives, is currently playing. So,
it's still playing. It's still playing. Don't worry.
Yeah, it'll be going through August. So tune in. Yeah. Even if it's done, go in. It's not a. It's over there at thebestminutes.com, where you can find it on iTunes or wherever you're listening to this podcast. You can probably find us there too.
Okay, great. And hopefully you'll come back tomorrow to continue discussing this heist movie.
I've got piles of things to say. So yes, please come back tomorrow.
Okay, great. So you can contact us by email, thegreatminute@gmail.com. Our Facebook group is The Cooler, The Cooler. Our website is thegreatescapeminute.com. You can contact us on Twitter @greatescapemxm. Please go and rate and review us on any podcatcher that you may use. And we shall see you tomorrow. Tally-ho!
Tally-ho!
Tally-ho!